The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly Guest Dharma series.
Welcome again, everyone. Nice to see so many people here on a hot, sticky night. So we're very grateful to have Roger Jackson here speaking to the community. Some of you probably saw that he's a professor down at Carleton in the Religion and Humanities Department. I'm not sure, is that the department? Religion and Humanities?
Yeah, just religion, yeah.
Just religion.
Yeah.
And some of you also know that because Ajahn Chattiko, when he's visited the last several years, has mentioned that Roger Jackson was one of his professors early on back, I guess, in the early 80s, maybe, and inspired him about Buddhism, and then from there studied Zen and eventually to Thailand and ordained as a monk. So then we get a good teacher starting out through an inspiration at Carleton College. It's a beautiful story. Roger Jackson's unusual in that he's also a practitioner, and some of you know in the academic world it's not always okay to be sort of an academic and somebody actually as a human being interested in the subject that you're teaching. And so this is the objective or something, as if that's possible. So this is an important perspective, much like Andy Olensky and others that have visited and taught here, to have somebody who really understands the subject as a scholar and has spent the amount of time it takes to really understand it on that level, and somebody who's done the experimentation with their own mind and practice. So really grateful that you're here, Roger. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Mark. I'm very pleased to be here, happy to be asked, and it's the first time I've been here. It's a lovely facility, very nice feeling about it. You're mentioning Andy Olensky. I also had I had Andy's son, Nick, as a student a few years ago at Carleton as well. And I must say that Ajahn Chattiko changed in many ways over the years between when I first met him in the 1984 and the current day. And I also have to say he's probably the single Carleton student I'm proudest of. and I'm happy to be a student of his now and again. So it's very nice to have it work that way. When Mark first approached me about speaking to you about some topic, karma was one of the ones that was sort of generally tossed around, and I've never really given a talk on karma per se, I don't think, so this is a bit of an experiment. And Mark also suggested that I try to gear it to some degree to practice, but I have to confess that for me, practice has always been very closely connected with a kind of intellectual inquiry into the historical context and the philosophical problems that are associated with the attempt to be a Buddhist, to do Buddhist meditation. So what I'm going to, again, experiment with a little bit tonight is an attempt to get at the concept of karma from a slightly more scholastic point of view, perhaps, than is the norm here. I don't know. I haven't come to other talks, but because that's my own background and orientation, I figured that was what I could most easily and perhaps most profitably share. What I plan to do, and I hope that I've probably got a dissertation here, so I'm going to have to. I've got points where I can cut to the chase if need be, but once you start on something like this, it really takes off. But what I plan to do in any case is, after just a couple of more introductory remarks, try to give you some sense of the contexts out of which the idea of karma came in the Indian setting of the middle of the first millennium BCE, both the non-Buddhist and the Buddhist context. So what was going on with discourse about karma at the time of the Buddha, roughly. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about what I would describe as the classical Buddhist view of karma, try to outline it very generally, give some classical definitions that go back to the Pali Canon and the Abhidharma literature, as well as talk about some of the nuances connected with the idea of karma as they developed over the centuries in India and then were worked on in other Buddhist cultures as well. I'm going to talk a little bit about some particular quote, ethical applications of karma, just to give you a sense of that. And I want to spend a little bit of time, if I have the time, talking about what I would call a kind of counter discourse on karma that comes out of the Mahayana traditions. Most of my focus is going to be on what we might describe as mainstream Buddhism or foundational Buddhism, Theravada, if you will. And then at the very end, I want to ask, try to at least pose, and I certainly can't answer, I've been wrestling with these for 30 plus years, but pose what for me seem to be the kind of big questions about karma from, I suppose, the point of view of the philosopher slash practitioner. So that's what I have in mind. My two favorite definitions of karma don't actually come from a Buddhist context. The first of these is one that I suspect many of you have heard and have probably quoted on one occasion or another when you are trying to make sense of karma to non-Buddhist friends. And this is one, I'm not going to quote it verbatim, not being a scriptural scholar, but it is found in Galatians 6:7, and there's a similar passage in the book of Job that suggests that as ye sow, so shall ye reap. This is not the exact language of the Bible. This is the way it often comes across, that there is phraseology very similar to that. And this metaphor of sowing and reaping actually is very important to Buddhist discourse about karma as well, as I suspect many of you will have noticed. The other sort of favorite definition I have comes from a book that I am old enough to have read when it first came out, and in my haze of the time, appreciated to a considerable degree. And that's this is Baba Ram Dass's definition from Be Here Now, or Remember Be Here Now, if we're going to cite the title correctly. And his definition of karma there is, he who shits in road meets flies on return. I think this captures a, perhaps even better than the biblical quotation, a sense of it. There's one other kind of saying that I want to introduce before getting down to talking about context. And this is one that I've thought about, I haven't made much sense of over the years, but it's a favorite saying of Tibetan lamas, and my study has primarily been with Tibetan teachers over the years. It's a statement to the effect that it's far, far easier to plumb the profundities of the doctrine of shunyata, or emptiness, than it is to actually understand how karma works. In fact, the way karma works is only understood by the mind of an omniscient Buddha. So in that sense, karma is perhaps an even deeper mystery in Buddhism than something like shunyata, emptiness, no self, these doctrines that we tend to think are so profound. So to talk just a little bit about the context in which the idea of karma seems to have arisen, I'm going to talk a little bit about pre-Buddhist contexts, because after all, the Buddha didn't arise in a vacuum, you all know that, and then talk about some of the sort of basic Buddhist context for discussions of the idea. In the pre-Buddhist setting in India, we have to recall that the earliest kind of religious tradition that we have any record of is the sort of Brahmanical tradition of the Vedas, the Rig Veda, the Yajur Veda, the Sama Veda, the Atharva Veda, and the whole kind of sacrificial ritual system that was associated with that. This is the earliest Indian religion of which we have any solid evidence. There were Indian religious practices before that of which we have flimsy evidence, but for these we have texts. And given that the religious tradition in this early era, and we're probably talking about 1000 BCE, 800 BCE roughly, in this very early period, there was a notion of karma. The word does appear. It's, as I suspect most of you know, it's derived from a Sanskrit verbal root that simply means to do. And the simplest translation of the word karma is action. In the context of a Vedic sacrificial ritual system, good karma, if you will, simply meant performing the sacrifice properly. And the proper performance of the sacrifice would, it was said, assure that after death you would be born in some kind of a heavenly realm. The world of the fathers was one of the most common terms for this. So there's a fairly limited, restricted, specialized notion of what karma is at the very beginnings in the Indian context. Now what happens sometime around the middle of the first millennium BCE, in a period that some people have described as the Axial Age. Karen Armstrong has made a great deal of this in some of her writings recently, but the idea goes back to Carl Jaspers in the early 20th century. This was an era in which in a number of different cultures, there was a kind of new profundity of thought in both metaphysics and ethics. And certainly in the Indian context, we find that there is a considerable shift in worldview. That the world that had been supported by the old Vedic ritual practices, by the caste system as it had been set up with the Brahmins at the top and so forth, all this was beginning to come under real question. There were social and technological changes that were occurring. It was kind of a brave new world of urbanization, new modes of warfare, and a great deal of uncertainty. All of this, to take a very long story and make it quite short, led to an increasing amount of sort of general disillusionment with the world. And it led, it seems, to the first development of the ideas of a kind of broader conception of the cosmos than had been found in the Vedic tradition, where there was heaven, perhaps there was a hellish realm, but mostly the focus was on this life. Now the idea began to arise, and this seems to be the earliest historical instance we have of this, though it's found in other cultures. The idea began to arise that perhaps this life that we have here is not the only one that we have had and not the only one that we will have. That we have lived before and we very well may live again. And the crucial point in all this, which obviously gives us the idea of reincarnation, is that to be born again was not a good thing. Life was unpredictable, capricious. It had its satisfactions and its miseries, but overall, it could not compare to a kind of idealized state of immortal bliss that might be found outside of what came to be known as the wheel of samsara, the circle of becoming. And for many people, there was a whole variety of speculation and practice and meditation that was going on in the cities, but more often in the forests of North India. People began to try to figure out if this in fact was the, if you will, the sentient condition, having to be born again and again, and if this was undesirable, what was it that caused us to be reborn? And for many, the answer was karma. Was action. The fact that we acted, and particularly acted in unskillful ways, which led to unfortunate results of one sort or another. So really the seeds of what will become the full-blown notion of karma can be traced to this mid-first millennium BCE. And we find in, as all of you I suspect know, the Buddha lived in this world of great intellectual and spiritual ferment. There were many other philosophical schools, both Brahmanical and anti-Brahmanical, that were, where people were striving to find real spiritual liberation, and were seeking to understand how the cosmos really worked. And when the Buddha articulated his own notions of karma, as he did reasonably clearly during his lifetime, it seems, he was in part reacting to other ideas about karma that had been developed in non-Buddhist schools. So for instance, in the text known as the Upanishads, which I suspect many of you have dipped into now and again, these are, of course, very important texts for Hindu traditions. There is an idea that actually, though we appear to act, our action is a kind of illusion, that there is only a single unchanging reality that projects the world. And our sense of ownership of our actions is actually quite mistaken. And it doesn't mean that we can't and won't be reborn if we don't understand who we really are. And who we really are is this single spiritual reality, Atman or Brahman. Anyway, this notion that on a certain level action is illusory, this would be an influential, if not necessarily always dominant, idea in many Hindu schools subsequently. There also were a couple of schools of thought that were anti-Brahmanical, and in that sense, roughly on the same side of the fence as the Buddhists, the Jains and the Ajivikas. And the Jains, of course, have continued to the present day as a very, very small but very influential religious tradition in India. Both the Jains and the Ajivikas had the sense that if karma was the cause of our suffering and of our future rebirth, then the simplest solution to this, the way to gain spiritual liberation, was to stop doing, simply cease action. And in fact, we don't have a lot left of Ajivika doctrines because they died out long, long ago, but the Jains continue to this day, and the Jains are famously probably the most rigorously ascetic school of philosophy and religion still extant in the world. And the notion is, in fact, that the less you do, the likelier it is that you will gain real spiritual liberation, because all action somehow involves us in suffering and therefore rebirth. There was a third kind of strand in the pre-Buddhist world that many of us would find familiar, if maybe not sympathetic today, and that was actually a materialist strand. There's been a materialist philosophical school in India for as far back as we can tell, and the materialists then, as perhaps materialists now, insisted that all these ideas about karma were totally foolish. We lived once, we had to enjoy life as it was, and then we died, and that was it. No liberation, no real cause and effect, as other schools tended to begin to articulate the idea of karma. So it was kind of against the background of this that the Buddha stated his own position. You recall from his first sermon or teaching that the Buddha, after all, was trying to kind of forge a middle way between what he regarded as extremes. And this idea of a middle way has been the central Buddhist trope for 2,500 years now. And so the Buddha tried to weave his way among these, to him, objectionable views of what the nature of action and karma were. Against the materialists, for instance, he insisted that, you know, there is karma, cause and effect works, I'll say more about this in a moment, and there is rebirth, and that there is both logical and experiential evidence for believing this to be the case. Against the Jain and Ajivika ideas that we simply had to stop doing in order to get rid of the karma that causes us to suffer and causes us to be reborn, the Buddha said, you've misunderstood the nature of action. You're regarding action as primarily being a matter of physical or verbal action, as if you could sort of, and there are actually Jain images of this, stand still in the forest for 15 years and get liberated by standing still. For the Buddha, karma was far less a physical and verbal matter, though it involved those, as it was, and much more a mental and psychological matter. And this was, of course, one of the crucial contributions of the Buddha to thinking about karma. Finally, in terms of the Brahmanical and sort of proto-Hindu view of action as really being performed by this unchanging, pure spiritual entity, the Buddha, as I suspect most of you know, rejected the existence of any kind of pure, permanent being, and said that it was totally incomprehensible how a being that didn't change could somehow act or be involved in action in the world. Because action involves change, action and reaction, and that which does not change simply is incomprehensible in light of this. So the Buddha rejected all of these. Now, in terms of asserting the Buddhist view of karma, there's a couple of points that are perhaps most important to make here. First is that if we take the kind of cornerstones of the Buddhist worldview, the Four Noble Truths, karma really works in terms of the second and fourth noble truths. That is, it tends to be articulated in terms of the truth of the origination or source of suffering and the truth of the path. And above all, ideas about karma, discourse about karma, tends to be located in discussions of the second noble truth. Because after all, if karma, action, is at least in part the source of our sufferings and hence of our rebirth, we have to understand how it works to originate those things that we seek to avoid and seek to escape. Most importantly, within the context of the Second Noble Truth, which of course covers many, many different matters, discussions of karma generally fall under the rubric of analyses of the idea of dependent arising or dependent origination, paticca samuppada in Pali, pratitya samuppada in Sanskrit. This is of course the generally stated view that that whatever comes into being through a cause or more than one cause. In the kind of classic formulation of it, this being that arises. From the arising of this comes the arising of that. This ceasing, that ceases. From the ceasing of this comes the ceasing of that. This is a fundamental formulation of it that, in fact, when articulated to potential disciples, sometimes resulted in their immediate liberation. And formulations of the theory of dependent origination in this form or a slightly altered one took on a kind of ritual power in Buddhism, such that they're found in sculptures carved in 8th century India and 15th century Tibet even. So there was this sense that this notion of dependent arising, of what in effect is a universal causal law, was absolutely central to Buddhist thought. And it's important to say, when we're talking about a universal moral law, that, or sorry, a universal causal law, that this involves every level of the cosmos. I mean, I'll say a little bit more about this later, but we tend to think, growing up in the kind of scientific culture that we do, that causation is primarily limited to the physical level. We can study physics, we can study Newtonian laws, we can study a variety of different ways of understanding causation on the physical level, but causation for the Buddha was a law that applied all across the board. And in fact, the particular psychological and moral instantiation of this universal causal law is karma. So it's a specific application of a broader law. And the particular context then in which karma is most often and most classically discussed, and I won't take the time to go through these, I suspect most of you are familiar with these to one degree or another, is in terms of discussions of the famous 12 links of dependent arising or dependent origination. This is a sequence of sort of causes and effects through which, starting with ignorance, one goes on to experience birth after birth after birth after birth. The details of it need not detain us now. The crucial point here is that within the evolving Buddhist context, the central factor in the perpetuation of suffering and of our being reborn is karma, but karma itself, actions of one sort or another, turn out to be rooted in something more fundamental, which is usually described as ignorance. This is the first of the 12 links of dependent arising. This is the root of samsara. And ignorance, of course, takes on many forms, but as the Buddhist tradition evolved, as I suspect most of you know, the particular form of ignorance that had to be overcome was the ignorant belief in some kind of a permanent self. As long as you believed in that, whether intellectually or at a gut level, and most of us are born with that feeling at a gut level, you were going to try to get things for this illusory self, try to defend this illusory self against real and perceived threats. And when you do that, you generate the whole host of emotions and attitudes that are connected with desire and anger, or desire and aggression. And these, in turn, become the basis for actual actions. And actions, being as they are, will inevitably bring results. So there's this kind of causal chain that's set up with ignorance at its root, desire and anger rooted in ignorance, leading to deluded actions which lead to unfortunate results. And this is kind of the key to the analysis of the Second Noble Truth. The implication of all that, of course, is that if we can undo this, if we can undo desire and hatred, and if, above all, we can undo ignorance, then the whole chain will fall apart and liberation will be the eventual, if not the immediate, result. So this is a very general statement of the kind of early Buddhist view of karma and its place in the cosmos. One other point to make about this is that karma produces not just events or effects in our own lives, but it's quite clear from very early on that there is a notion that karma produces also effects in the world and the environment in a more general way. So it's not just that your performance of certain actions will lead to certain effects for you in this life or some future life. It's that our performance of actions, and particularly our performance of actions within a kind of collective or social context, leads to, in a way we can probably easily understand, effects in the world. But there's an even stronger sense of this, even in early Buddhism, to the degree that the world itself in some way is rooted in the actions of beings. The world almost comes into creation through the acts of beings. And this, of course, those of you who are familiar with the famous first verse of the Dhammapada, which in my favorite, even though it's not the most accurate translation, goes, all that we are is a result of what we have thought. It is founded on our thoughts. It is made up of our thoughts. This is a very clear statement of the profound centrality and importance that Buddhists have always put on the mind and the degree to which the mind, we might say, both affects the world and effects the world. So this is not something that necessarily is endemic to our culture and our way of thinking about things, but I think it's been rooted in Buddhism from the very beginning. So to switch then from the kind of this kind of broad introductory context to something like the classical Buddhist view, I'm going to start with actually quoting a general definition of karma that's given in one of the most famous of all Buddhist Abhidharma texts, and this is the Abhidharma Kosha of Vasubandhu, which dates from probably the 4th or 5th century. And Vasubandhu, in fact, is paraphrasing a statement by the Buddha found in the Anguttara Nikaya of the Pali Canon. I won't quote you the Pali source right now, but it's quite clear that Vasubandhu is borrowing from this. And here is Abhidharma Kosha 4.1. He says, the variety of the world arises from action. This is a point I was just trying to make. Action, which is intention, and what is produced by intention. Intention is mental action. It gives rise to two actions, physical and verbal actions. Now, I'm not going to unpack all of this, but focus probably on the central portion of this, which is the statement to the effect that action is intention and what is produced by intention. This is a little bit abstract, but it becomes clearer, I think, when you kind of take it piece by piece. The first and most central point about this, and if you remember nothing else about what I've said tonight, remember this, that the classical Buddhist definition of karma, and again, we can take this right back to the Pali Canon, is as intention or volition. It's very hard to know exactly how to translate this Pali/Sanskrit word chaitana, but it has this notion of both volition and intention. That is the deliberate desire for something or to do something. And this places the core of what karma is squarely in the realm of the mental. Karma is above all a matter of mind. But the second half of the statement, it said, you know, karma or action is intention and what is produced by intention. What is produced by intention then are the various verbal and physical acts or bodily acts as well as subsequent mental acts that may arise from that particular intention. And these together, then, the original intention to do something and the verbal or physical outcome of that intention are what in the tradition are generally called projecting karma. That is, they will lead to actions that will project a particular result at some future time. And there are many and long and detailed discussions of the various types of projecting karmas, and there is no great agreement, no universal agreement on how these ought to be classified, but there is general agreement that sooner or later, the karma that has been projected at a given moment, I mean, you know, just take the example, you kill somebody, there is a definite karmic result that will come from that. And at the point where you actually experience the result of that, whether it's in the next minute, later in this life, or in some future life, then you have what's called finishing karma, which is the karma that completes the action that was projected earlier in this life or perhaps many lives ago. Again, there's no agreement on it. There's many discussions of what sort of actions will lead to immediate consequences or definite consequences in the next life or, you know, 50 lives down the road. And I won't go into those. The crucial thing is to understand that you think something, you intend something, you speak and act in a certain way, and that projects some kind of result that eventually will be finished up, as it were. And then you will be done with that karma. The best way to understand the interim between projecting a karma and experiencing the finish of that karma is to go back to the metaphor that I invoked at the beginning from the Bible, a kind of vegetative metaphor. The metaphor, and the Buddhists use this with great frequency, the metaphor of sowing seeds, which then continue and will eventually come to fruition when circumstances are right. And this is an image used again and again and again in all sorts of Buddhist contexts. And, you know, if we think about the relative speed with which different kinds of plants come to fruition or to fullness, we can understand how different sorts of actions or different sorts of karmas will finally be finished in less time or more time, depending on what they are. So this is kind of the core definition of karma in the classical system. I want to talk a little bit then about a few more particular characteristics of this, given this kind of a definition. And one of these is a list. I haven't sort of traced the origins of this exactly. I've come upon this primarily in Tibetan teachings, but I'm quite sure they're found in the Abhidharma texts, like those of Vasubandhu or Asanga, or different figures from the early first millennium. And that is that there are, beyond this basic definition of karma as intention and what's produced by intention, there are characteristics that karma has that are sort of immutable, to the degree that anything is immutable in Buddhism. And there are more things immutable than you might suspect, actually, on the ideological level. There are four points that are made here. One, karma is definite. Two, karma is expandable. Three, if a karma is not produced, you're not going to get the result of it. And when a karma is produced, the result is inevitable. Now, I'm going to say a little bit more about each of these and talk about some interesting consequences and perhaps some exceptions to these rules. The first is that karma is definite. And what this generally means in the interpretations I've read and heard is that a particular quality of action will meet with a particular commensurate result. And in particular, that positive actions, in the broadest way of speaking about things, positive actions will eventuate in positive outcomes and results. Negative actions lead to negative or unfortunate results. The metaphors they'll often use are to the effect that, you know, a cactus seed can only produce a cactus and an apple seed can only produce an apple. You know, there is a definite quality that a given karma has. And the results will be appropriate to that. Again, as you sow, so shall you reap. There's an important qualification on, several important qualifications on this. One, a lot of it depends on what particular realm of samsara you happen to be in. The human's the one we happen to remember best at the moment. But according to traditional Buddhists anyway, we've been in many other realms at many other times. But quite apart from that, whether we're humans or hell beings or long life gods somewhere, there's no doubt whatsoever that our actual human experience or actual sentient experience is something of a mix, right? And there are, in fact, sophisticated and interesting discussions of the degree to which karmas, even despite this notion of karma being definite, you know, positive goes to positive, negative goes to negative, that karmas can be complicated and mixed. And I'll say a little bit more about this in a moment when I talk about the notion of the gravity of karma as tradition discusses it. So karma's definite, but karma is also very, very complicated and highly calibrated. Karma is expandable. This is a notion that's fairly terrifying on a certain level, particularly if you subscribe to ideas of rebirth, that if you perform a particular action and it has a particular result over the course of time, that result may kind of naturally expand in terms of the severity or gravity that will ultimately be the finishing karma that is experienced. The acorn and the oak is perhaps the classic example. There's not an Indian example, but one that I think we can easily understand. It's particularly plays in, not so much in Theravada context that I'm familiar with, but in Mahayana context where there actually is a ritual of confession. This point, it's stressed, the expandability of karma is stressed partly as a way to ensure that you confess on a daily basis your own karmic transgressions, and this helps to purify them and mitigate them and keep them from expanding in this way. The flip side of this, of course, on the positive, I've been accentuating the negative here, which is what Buddhists tend to do in their classical discourse about karma. But remember, on the positive side, if karma is expandable, then some good seed will have magnificent results in the long term if cultivated properly. Just to cheer you up for a moment. The third point that if you don't perform an action, you don't get the result seems kind of self-evident, but again, it's important to stress this, and it means, first of all, on the most obvious level, that on the one hand, whatever we experience is the result of something we've done before. And if we don't do a particular act, don't perform a particular act, we're not going to get the results of that kind of action. And this, of course, has a fairly strong moral, if not moralistic, set of implications. The other element of this notion that no action, you know, not performing the action leads to not getting the result, is an actually subtler kind of psychological and philosophical distinction that's made between acting and accumulating acting. This is, or accumulating an action. And Buddhists, and this is linked in with this very important idea that karma is only really karma if there's intention behind it. So there's a whole category of mental activities, if you will, that don't really bear karmic results. They don't accumulate karma that will have to be finished and experienced at some point. And there's a list of 10 of them that I saw in the Abhidharma Kosha. I only noted down a few of these, but just to give you an example, things that you think or do in dreams don't have karmic consequences. When you do something out of a sort of mistaken sense of something, not in the metaphysical sense, but just you're mistaken about something, then you don't really have the proper intention, so it doesn't have the same kind of karmic results. If you're not paying attention, if you're inattentive, that doesn't have the same kind of karmic results. I mean, there's much one could argue and discuss about all of this, but there is, in any case, this notion that even though we, quote, do these things, they don't have karmic consequences in the same ways that intentional acts do. The final of these four kind of general characteristics of karma is the idea, which is, I think, corollary to number three, that when an action is performed, the result is definite. It's going to happen sooner or later. It may be way later, but it will happen. But, and there's an important qualification to this one. And without this important qualification, I think we'd all be in utter despair and Buddhism would just evolve into a form of existentialism. Because after all, given the fact that we think about this for a second, we've lived infinite lives before, literally infinite lives before. Time is beginningless, mind is beginningless, the accumulation of karma has been beginningless. And therefore, there is quite literally an infinity of projecting karmas that have yet to be finished. You would never have enough time to experience the results of all the karma you've got lurking there in your mind stream and your fourth aggregate, the aggregate of mental formations, or the grab bag, as one of my professors once described it. So that seems to pose a kind of philosophical paradox that liberation must be impossible. But the important qualification here is that well, number one, as I suggested before, in certain contexts, acts of confession can help to mitigate, if not completely destroy, these karmic seeds. But more importantly, and here's where we kind of circle back for a moment to the second noble truth, if ignorance, and especially the ignorant belief in a persisting self, is the source of the deluded actions that lead to unfortunate results, if we actually undermine thoroughly, not just intellectually, but at a gut level, at a meditative level, if we undermine this ignorant belief in a persisting self, that will keep us from developing the desire, the anger that lead to negative actions, that lead to negative results. And therefore, what you do is you, in effect, defang, well, that's mixing the metaphor, what you do is you burn up the seeds of all these karmas that have been accumulated since beginningless time. So that infinity of unfructified karma is in fact an illusion in a way. It's not an illusion, it's very real in a conventional sense, but and you really want to get away from it, but it can be burned up, if not in an instant, very, very quickly, once the real nature of reality is understood. And all the Buddhists, the kind of classic Abhidharma and other Buddhist discussions of the path system, talk about this crucial moment on the path where you cease being an ordinary being and you become an Arya being, a holy being, a noble being. Again, Arya is a very hard word to translate. But at that moment, you have a direct realization of how things really are. In the context of the Pali Canon, it's often a direct realization of the truth of the Four Noble Truths. In other settings, it'll be a direct realization of no self or of emptiness. And this realization, again, at more than an intellectual, at a meditative level with a concentrated mind, begins the process of not just suppressing, but uprooting. Again, there's that vegetative kind of metaphor, or burning up these unfructified karmic seeds. So, you know, the result is inevitable, but no, it really isn't. There is hope. And talk for a minute then about some sort of particular ethical applications. I'm going to run through these reasonably quickly. Most of you, I suspect, have read in and out of Buddhist literature and know that the kind of classical Buddhist, you might say applied karma theory, is spoken of most generally in terms of 10 non-virtues. This is a classic list that comes up in the Pali Canon, and you can follow it all the way through Buddhist literature, all throughout Asia. And, you know, going back to this idea that the sorts of actions that we have are threefold, physical, verbal, and mental, these 10 non-virtues are divided accordingly. And so there are three physical non-virtues, namely killing, stealing, and sexual misconduct, however that may be defined in a given context. There are four verbal non-virtues, lying, harsh speech, slander, and idle gossip, and three mental non-virtues, covetousness, malice, and wrong view. And these 10 constitute, it's not like 10 commandments exactly. The Buddha didn't frame things in quite that quite the same manner as, say, Moses coming down from Sinai. But I've sometimes said to people that these aren't exactly the Ten Commandments. It's more like the Ten Suggestions. Sort of, you know, the Buddha said something to the effect that it's been my experience that if you do these 10 things, or even one of these 10 things, you're going to get results that you really don't like, so you might try to avoid them. So it doesn't have quite the same tone, but the effect is often the same, and particularly when you build in a metaphysic that involves multiple lives, involves the possibility of hellish or ghostly rebirths. Buddhists can actually do about as well in the hellfire and brimstone area as Christians can, I've found. The opposite of this, of course, is that there are 10 virtues, which are the non-performance of these non-virtues, and those are, of course, conducive to proper practice of the path and ultimately to liberation. Now, this is a very broad and, you might say, kind of coarse categorization of morality and of you know, bad actions, if you will. And it's important to note that from very early on, and again, we find this even in as early as the Pali Canon, there were discussions of the so-called gravity of karma. So it was understood that, you know, you can't just say, well, there's these 10 bad things, don't do them, you know, no questions asked. It was understood that, as I've suggested before, this whole system of karma is so incredibly finely calibrated that you can never fully untie it or unknot it. But it's important to understand that there are nuances to the whole thing. For instance, it's said that among those 10 actions, the physical non-virtues are the worst. Verbal non-virtues are not quite as bad as that, and the mental non-virtues are the least negative of all. In spite of the fact, of course, that ironically it's in the mental realm that all of these originate, so there's a kind of an interesting tension there. But the more important point is that if we take a particular instance of one of the non-virtues, and let's just take the instance of killing, which is the first of the list of non-virtues, and is always in any virtually any Buddhist vow system that I've ever seen, this is the first one. It's the first of the vows that a monk or a nun should not transgress. So this is very, very basic, but you know, killing is not always, one act of killing is not the same as another act of killing. It's not as if, you know, you kill in one way and you kill in another. It's all going to lead to the same karmic result. There are all sorts of, if you will, mitigating circumstances that will determine the gravity of a given act of killing, or mutatis mutandis, any of these other kinds of non-virtues. So, you know, first of all, this is always the first point, you've got to have the intention to kill. If you don't have the intention, then the act really is not complete. If you inadvertently, inattentively step on an insect, in most Buddhist systems that I've seen, this is not killing in the full sense of the term. There may be some negativity involved, perhaps inattentiveness. We could discuss whether that is itself negative in some way, but having the intention is basic. It's the sine qua non for anything truly being an instance of karma. And then there are all sorts of qualifications depending on who the agent is, who the object is, the manner in which it's done, the frequency with which an action is performed, and whether the act is seen through to completion. Let me give you, this is an exaggeration, but it'll give you a feel for the two different instances of an example of killing that are clearly calibrated very, very differently. If you were with full intention to, as a being who has studied Buddhism and therefore clearly ought to know better, go up to your father, I can't remember if it was father or mother, anyway, and give the proverbial 40 whacks, and then again give your other parent the proverbial 41 whacks. this is the Lizzie Borden, anyway, sorry, maybe that dates me. Lizzie Borden took an axe and gave her mother 40 whacks, and when she saw what she had done, she gave her father 41. This is a really negative karma. There is, you know, you are someone who ought to know better. The object of it is apparent, and parents and enlightened beings are sort of the supreme beings to be valued. You do it with viciousness, you do it repetitively, and you're satisfied at the outcome. This is bad karma. This is what will be called an uninterrupted bad karma, which actually means that in the very next life, guaranteed, do not pass go, do not collect anything, straight to hell. Take as an example on another extreme. You're in a zone where encephalitis is common, and you're out at dusk and you're not fully covered up, and a mosquito lands on your neck, and you're worried about the strong possibility that you might get encephalitis, and you deliberately swat the mosquito. Now that is an act of killing. It's intentional. It's seen through to completion, but you do it once. Only in this particular circumstance, you do it regretfully. It's my life or yours. And so, you know, two very, very different instances. Just a way of showing you that karma is not this broad and kind of crude way of understanding the kind of moral processes of the cosmos, but a very, very subtle one. So the overall picture that arises from this, in terms of the classical system, just to summarize some points that I hope I've been making with sufficient force along the way, is that in its classical setting, the idea of karma is part of a larger metaphysical system that involves belief in a repeated series of rebirths, in which, you know, and a whole scheme of suffering and salvation in which karma plays a kind of crucial role. And, you know, acting in the proper way and avoiding improper ways of acting will be determinative in some ways of what your destiny will be, metaphysically speaking. In this whole idea of karma, the physical and the verbal are important, but the mental is central. Intention, above all, is the definition of karma. All experiences that we have are the result of some previous action we've committed, but not all actions lead to results necessarily. Not everything that we do will lead to a result, because there are these instances of, say, inattention or dream or error. And, of course, there are the actions of liberated beings, which do not bear karmic consequences. The whole point of all of this classical system, in the Pali Canon, in the Abhidharma, in any past system you care to read about, is to stop doing negative things and perform positive things. The classic statement, one of the pithy statements of the Buddhist path that you'll come up against, quoted very, very often, again from somewhat later in the Dhammapada, is to the effect that to shun all evil, to perform what is good, to purify the mind. This is the teaching of the Buddhists. Very, very simple, basic statement. And karma is kind of at the heart of that. A quick note on some counter discourses to this before I try to wrap it up with a few kind of big questions that are insoluble. Those of you who have read in and out of Mahayana literature will recognize that one of the most popular rhetorical ploys of the Mahayana is a kind of negative discourse. Now, Buddhism is famous for negative discourse. If no self, for instance, is the basic philosophical truth that Buddhists say we have to understand, then there's a shred of negativity there right from the beginning. But in the Mahayana context, even the kinds of things that I've been talking about and articulating as this classical system of samsara, karma, liberation, rebirth, and so forth, even these come under question. Just to quote you, or at least paraphrase in most cases here, just a few Mahayana sources that seem to negate everything that I've just been talking about. The Buddhaguhya Sutra, or the Buddha Secret Sutra, has a famous statement to the effect that From the moment he attained liberation until the moment he passed into final nirvana, the Buddha never uttered a single word. He never did a single thing. In effect, there was no karma. And furthermore, that there's no being anywhere that actually performs any karma. The Heart Sutra, which some of, I suspect most of you have read at some time or another, very explicitly says that in emptiness, O Shariputra, there is no suffering, no origination, no cessation, no path. The truth of origination, which is where karma is found, is negated. It's said to be empty. And the Diamond Sutra has a number of passages in which the whole idea of merit and virtue is just blown out of the water, said to be utterly empty. These are said to be non-existent. The Yogacara, the great philosopher Nagarjuna, who's arguably the greatest of all Buddhist philosophers, in his famous stanzas on the middle way in the 17th chapter, which is all about karma, sets up the kind of description that I've set up for you, and then proceeds in the last 15 or so verses of this chapter to basically demonstrate that there is no action, there is no agent, there is no object of an action, and that all of these are completely empty concepts. The Yogacara school, the sort of idealistic school of Buddhist philosophy, talks about the three worlds and all the beings and actions within it as simply being mind only, not being real in any substantial sense of the term. And when you get down then to the traditions I'm most interested these days in studying, the tantric traditions of late Indian and Tibetan Buddhism, and you come across figures like Tilopa and Naropa, and my particular favorite, Sadaha, you find poems in which it's said, for instance, that those who are freed are done with deeds. And you come across in the tantras and in tantric poetry these lengthy descriptions of the eccentric behavior that a yogi ought to entertain, which involves transgressing all sorts of social and sexual and other social norms. So you've got this whole discourse that's set up in the Mahayana that seems to just negate everything, and it begins to sound like some kind of nihilism. The points to make quickly about this, because I don't want to go off on too much of a tangent, is that the crucial matter always to understand when reading Mahayana discourse, or in fact in reading much of the discourse of Asian wisdom literature, is that there is a sometimes explicit but more often implicit distinction in two different levels of discourse that's being made. And in Buddhist terms, this is Nagarjuna's phrase, you have to understand that there's a conventional level of speaking and there's an ultimate level of speaking. So when, for instance, Nagarjuna or the Heart Sutra or the Diamond Sutra says there is no origination, there is no karma, there is no action, or the Buddhaguya Sutra says the Buddha never said a word, all this is from the standpoint of ultimate truth. And it has to do with establishing that there's no inherently or intrinsically existing action. And another way of saying this is actually, Nagarjuna himself makes this point very strongly, emptiness, voidness, is just another way of saying that things are dependently originated, that they're relative and interdependent. So what looks scary and nihilistic on the philosophical level isn't really that way. And in fact, Nagarjuna, like virtually all Mahayana philosophers, accepts the conventional account that I've given you on a conventional level. They will say that you have to understand, however, that these don't ultimately exist, that they are empty. And when you get to these issues of sort of the behavior of a bodhisattva or of a tantric mahasiddha or great adept, the kinds of things I quoted from Saraha, you know, these have to do with notions of the bodhisattva's ability to use all sorts of skillful means to advance others on the path to liberation, including sometimes unconventional actions. But the crucial point here, and this brings us back, and shows us how deeply rooted this actually is in classical Buddhism, that a bodhisattva's skillful means is only going to really be skillful means if the intention is pure. So if you have a good intention, then you can act in ways that may seem unconventional or even transgressive. So that's just a sort of brief excursus on the Mahayana. Finally, sorry that I've gone on longer than I should have here, but I'll just sort of pose without going much at all into them, at least five questions. There are many more, but these were the five that sort of occurred to me as questions that I've kicked around over the years. And Buddhists, and some of these are questions that I think we might only ask as modern people. Some of these are questions that Buddhists themselves have wrestled with. The first one is in fact a classical question that Buddhists have struggled with and had to defend their views of in relation to other schools. And that is how you can reconcile the idea of karma, that is that as ye sow, so shall you reap. As you intend, so shall you reap. So shall you eventually experience results. How do you get this idea to correspond with the absence of any persisting self? The idea of no self is, if you will, the great koan of Buddhism right from the beginning. And to give a coherent account of how the cosmos works without a persisting self has been the greatest challenge of Buddhist philosophy. And it certainly, on the surface, seems counterintuitive to say that, on the one hand, we don't have any self, and on the other hand, I perform an action, and I, not only in this life, but in some future life, may get the result. So that's one question. This is a second question, and I think this is one that I've asked. I'm not sure if this is asked as much within the tradition, but I sometimes have wondered whether, given the kind of detail, extraordinary, sometimes excruciating detail that Buddhists go into about the ways in which particular actions are linked to particular results, and how any given experience can always be explained on the basis of some previous action, if karma, the theory of karma, doesn't end up explaining so much that it explains nothing at all. That is, it comes to serve a kind of a... I'm going to give you this analogy, and you may or may not agree with me, but it sometimes strikes me that karma is used by people in Buddhism in the same way that the idea of the will of God is used in a Christian setting. That is, we don't know exactly why when I walked out of this building tonight I was struck by lightning, but I must have done something. And, you know, in a Christian context, there would be, well, you know, it's time to be with God, or go to hell, or whatever the case may be. So, you know, there is this difficulty that it's so all purpose, it's so useful that it almost becomes useless in a way. And you begin to say, well, yeah, it's karma, but what are the other causes of it? So anyway, there's this difficulty that I've detected sometimes. A question, and again, this is a question that has been asked by many modern people, not just of Buddhists, but of Hindus and Jains and others who believe in both karma and rebirth, is whether this idea of the kind of inevitable consequences of particular deeds and the fact that what we experience now is a result of things we have done before, whether this doesn't lead on a social and perhaps political level to a kind of fatalism and conservatism. This was, of course, a classic Orientalist critique of Indian ideas in the colonial period. But it's not that kind of cultural analysis notwithstanding. There certainly have been any number of people in both Buddhist and Hindu settings who have taken karma in a kind of fatalistic vein and said, well, you know, whatever I've got, I deserve, after all. This, you know, what I did something in a previous life or perhaps earlier in this life that merits this, and I've simply got to live it through. So this is, I think, one of the troubling questions on a kind of social political level. A fourth question that's occurred to me, and I think to some other people along the way, is whether the particular judgments that are implicit in karmic valuations or in the definitions and details of what's negative karma and what's positive karma really is reflected in some objective way in the nature of things, and that's certainly what a classical Buddhist would insist to you, or as we in a modern or perhaps postmodern vein might suggest, whether these aren't themselves social constructions to some degree that are then given this kind of metaphysical warrant, very much in which you could, and again, just to give you a parallel example, just as we could say that the Ten Commandments are posited as coming down as the Word of God, but a modern non-believer would simply say these were particular social values among the Hebrews in the 13th century BC or whatever, and they were projected into a divine realm to give them authority and give them social force. Well, you could make very much the same point about the 10 non-virtues and particularly some of the details. You know, the classical Buddhist claim is, you know, this is just the way things are. You kill in a particular way and there will be these results. But we might suggest that there are, you know, cultural values laden into all of this that throw the objectivity of all this into some question. The final question, this is perhaps the most open-ended of all, is just, you know, given all of this, what sense we as modern people can make of the idea of karma? You know, given especially the fact that growing up, as most of us do, in a scientific, if not outright scientistic culture, we tend to believe that causation is largely restricted to the physical and we're not so sure about the mental or the psychological, at least in the detailed sense in which Buddhists often articulate it. We have considerable doubts about the power and the predictability of the human mind, you know, Freud and many generations of psychologists notwithstanding. We have a great deal of skepticism, I think, about the objectivity of moral claims and moral judgments. And certainly most of us, I shouldn't speak for people here, but I'm largely agnostic on the question of past and future lives. In spite of reading many arguments in favor of it, I have yet to be thoroughly persuaded, and I'm afraid my experience doesn't yet impinge on that realm. So, you know, where all this leaves us in terms of thinking about karma, I sort of leave open for discussion and would be happy to take questions, comments, or anything else at this point. Yeah?
Is intention ever defined, or how is it defined in the different scriptures, especially positive intention, and is there a practical test that people can use to kind of...
That's interesting. I have not run into a great deal of discussion of it. I mean, beyond what I suggested before, that there is a degree of awareness of it, and this volition intention that is directed towards some object and the performance of some action in relation to some object. There may be, again, there's a lot of stuff out there I haven't read, but that's about the level to which I've been able to trace it to this point. Yeah?
So, I'm understanding everything has a karmic cause.
Mm-hmm.
So what would be the original action or intention that set it all off, or is time meant to be described as a circle with no beginning and no end?
It's not a circle. Exactly, although circular imagery is often used, and people will talk about, for instance, the term samsara is often translated as the cycle of existence. But it's not, samsara actually doesn't mean a cycle, it means a running on, a flowing on. And the idea is that there simply is no beginning. So when I said we have literally an infinity of previous lives, that at least in the classical tradition is exactly what's meant. It's very hard for us in a religious context where Genesis, the idea of Genesis is central, and a scientific culture in which the Big Bang is the, you know, latest idea about the beginning of things, it's very hard for us to think about things sort of just, you know, if there was a life before this and a life before this, there's always a previous life. So there isn't any beginning. So mind is beginningless and we are beginninglessly deluded. And you know, this way, I still remember when my wife and I first got really serious about Buddhism, which was at a meditation course in Nepal many, many years ago. We stood at the bottom of Kopan Hill for about half an hour and just said, in other words, we've actually sat in meditation on this hill for 30 days, infinite times before, You know, with the same group of people, by the same token, we've all sat together in this room infinite times before and had this discussion, and yet none of us got it. So, you know, some of you may have heard this famous, and I believe it's an Indian story about a young boy who asks his father, you know, what the world rests on. And he says, well, the world rests on a tortoise. And he says, well, what does the tortoise rest on? He says, an elephant. And well, what does the elephant rest on? Father says, another elephant. Well, come on, what does the elephant? Look, son, it's elephants all the way down. But, you know, that's beginningless mind in a way. It's a hard one to get our minds around because it's beginningless.
Well, I've been wondering for years why is there more of a fascination about asceticism in northern India than other parts of the world?
I mean, I don't know that that's entirely true. It depends a lot on how you define asceticism. And Indian culture certainly has put asceticism, given a kind of value to asceticism that I don't think we certainly don't see so much in the modern era. But if you actually think back to the medieval period or the early period of Christianity, tales of the saints and the self-mortification and the temptations that they underwent, I think actually a stress on asceticism is a hallmark of many cultures at a particular point. And it has to do, in part, it's linked in Christian culture as in Indian cultures, with this larger notion that we only can gain true satisfaction, true happiness, if we deprive ourselves to a certain degree of the pleasures that lead us to act in ways, and now I'm getting into karmic theory again, that lead to particular results that we think are going to bring us happiness, but in fact don't. And this is a kind of reflection that we see evolving in many cultures. And again, many people Karen Armstrong and Jaspers and others have said that the Axial Age, sort of the 6th, 5th, 4th centuries BCE, was a time in which, whether coincidentally or not, many cultures sort of reached this point. And I don't know why it persisted in India in quite the way it did, but there are many, many counter discourses to this, not just materialists, but those who insist that asceticism is not necessary for spiritual liberation. But you're certainly right that India has been an outstanding example. It's not the only example by any means. Did you have a
thought? Well, kind of speaking to your last question about physics and gravity and cosmic universe law, and you know, even at physics at the subatomic level, there's a cosmic.
Right. Right, and it's very and this is not my not my area at all. My science ended in 10th grade biology, to be honest. But it's very. If any of you have read, if you haven't, I'd recommend it. A book by the Dalai Lama called "The Universe in a Single Atom." This is an extraordinarily sophisticated attempt by a classically trained Buddhist to come to terms with, you know, what seemed to me extremely sophisticated notions in a range of things, from astrophysics to evolutionary biology to quantum physics to theories of consciousness. And the whole quantum level of things is intriguing. And the Dalai Lama is, I think, if I recall correctly, I don't think he'll sort of give up that basic Buddhist belief in causation. I may be wrong about this because it's a while since I read it, but I think his bottom line is there's some kind of causation going on. It's just not of the sort that we're used to or can detect in the standard ways. And I realize that probably a quantum physicist would say you don't get it at all. But yeah.
I'm curious how you can say so easily, as you have twice, that we have had infinity of past lives, and then state in your fifth question that you're agnostic on rebirth or reincarnation.
Well, that was my personal stance. I've been here primarily trying to represent for you what the classical tradition says, and there are a series of there's a series of philosophical texts that were written in India between the 7th and 10th or 11th century, roughly, that took on these questions from a philosophical standpoint. My dissertation and then a book I eventually published was, which was called Is Enlightenment Possible? That was the name of both the dissertation and the book, deals with these arguments, which are attempts actually at a rational demonstration of the reality of past and future lives, of karma working the way it Buddhists say it does, of the possibility of liberation, and so forth. I've studied these a lot, and I don't find the proofs persuasive, to be honest. And again, I realize that's only one way in which you can come at acceptance of this. For me, as a kind of dyed-in-the-wool intellectual, the philosophical questions were the ones that impinged on me most strongly. I fully recognize that most Buddhists would say, you idiot, it's not something that can be proven rationally, and why did you spend all those years studying it? You've got to meditate, and if you achieve the fourth jhana or something, you'll have memory of past lives, and there it'll be. And I probably should have been working on the jhanas more than I was working on these arguments over the years. But it's that was my personal stance as opposed to what the tradition says. Yeah.
You referred to as the fourth aggregate as a little bit of a grab bag.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, those of you familiar with the five aggregates, the sort of basic categories of what makes up the psychophysical person, know that. Again, depending on how you translate these are form and sensations and perception or recognition. The fifth one is consciousness or awareness. The fourth is called mental formations. And my grad school teacher described it somewhat cynically as a grab bag because almost anything else that did fit into one of the other five was put there. So your sense of temporality is found there. Your particular proclivities and inclinations are found there. The seeds of previous karma that haven't yet borne fruit are contained there. And there's other things to be found as well, depending on the particular Buddhist philosophical system you're looking at.
So would instincts translate into that kind of?
That's part of it. I mean, but I think that's only part of it, and that's why it's hard to nail down. And there's never, I think, been an adequate translation. The word is the Sanskrit / Pali word is samskara, which itself means about 15 different things in Pali and Sanskrit, but literally means conformation. If you were to translate it literally, but it's this variety of different mental tendencies, proclivities, seeds, inclinations, dispositions to behave. If we want to get analytic, call analytic about it. Lots of different ways you can conceive of it, but there's a lot that's found in there.
As an agnostic, how would you explain the concept of tuku or reincarnated lama? Now, I'm not sure about me, and I know that there's a lot of times I've met or talked to people and it felt like there was something, but that's in my mind. But here's people like the Dalai Lama or other people that are known to be reincarnated lamas. How do you explain that?
Well, I mean, personally, I can't. If I'm being agnostic about it, then I'd probably say, well, maybe, maybe not. When I'm being a little more skeptical, I simply see it as a social institution that attributes a level of spiritual awareness to certain beings, reinforces that, it gives them authority within the society, it helps the authority to function in various ways. But obviously that's a sociological / anthropological view of it. Since I don't know about the metaphysics personally, not even knowing if there's another life after this one, then I can only say, well, this is what they say, and draw your own conclusions. It's interesting, the Dalai Lama himself, when he talks about the idea of being the Dalai Lama, and for instance, his relation to previous Dalai Lamas, is not as straightforward about that as you might expect. He doesn't talk about being the actual reincarnation, for instance, of the 13th Dalai Lama. There's a very interesting set of interviews conducted by a scholar named Thomas Layard, which is sort of it's a part of a larger history of Tibet that they worked on together. And the Dalai Lama talks of himself as feeling a kind of affinity with, or some kind of a connection with, these figures from a previous era, or this deity, Chenrezig, of whom he's supposed to be the incarnation. So he himself gives, you know, a less straightforwardly metaphysical explanation of all this than many Tibetans themselves will give. But that's typical of the Dalai Lama. He will say things about his tradition that many Tibetans don't really know what to do with.
Yeah. You mentioned Sankara, and then you also mentioned sort of the way to kind of mitigate the future fruition of, karma. Is it specifically through meditation or through meditation and other things that kind of unwinds the Sankara or mitigates that future fruit?
Yeah, I mean, I think the kind of classic explanation is that through a combination of the performance of virtuous actions and through the practice of meditation, you shun or push aside negative karmas, cultivate positive karma. You know, again, if it's true that the positive leads to the positive, then the constant exercise of virtue will lead to the constant experience of positive results. But to actually get beyond all of that, to become liberated, you have to go beyond just morality, in effect. You have to meditate, and you have to come to a realization of the fact of no self with a mind that is sufficiently concentrated that you can, you know, really focus on it and experience it at a deep level. And that's when you have this experience that begins to, you know, in the metaphors I use, burn up or uproot these negative tendencies, the seeds of these negative seeds that have been sown in previous rebirths.
Yeah. How does this whole system, or the possibility of enlightenment, how does this work for people who are either born with some impaired mental functioning or who suffered a trauma somewhere along the line, mm-hmm. and don't have the ability to meditate or the intellectual capacity to understand the concept Jesus articulated? How does that work for those people?
Well, I mean,
there's a place for those people in this universe.
Well, in the classic Buddhist view, this isn't a problem in the slightest. Because whatever infirmity or different sin ability you may end up taking on in this life, there's all sorts of possibilities for a future life. Well, on one level, yes. On another, extremely optimistic. Because if you take the contrary view, okay, we've only got one life, and the only way you can get liberated is through meditation. Meditation requires clear mental faculties, and if through some accident or genetic, you know, change or whatever it may be, you don't have that, well, you know, you're out of luck. Maybe?
From a practical point of view, wouldn't there be the temptation to say someone who has such a handicap is a completely karma from some previous
Yeah.
action? And that would lead to that kind of social service in that
community. Right, and to a sense, and this is a tricky area, I think, to the weird sense, and this has been an argument that's been made, that somehow the person, quote, deserved it, right? I mean, you performed the act, you get the result. And, you know, this... I don't know how many people have read Susan Sontag's book on illness as metaphor, but... her discussion there of the ways in which we often sort of talk ourselves into thinking we deserve whatever physical affliction it is we get is linked in with this, and I think it's tricky in a lot of ways, and I think there's a lot of traps in this, particularly in this. I mean the flip side of it is that there always is the possibility, I mean, obviously we're all restricted by who we are, by our physical and social and other circumstances, but the system is not a fatalistic one ultimately, because in every given moment, there is in fact a possibility of proper chetana, intention, volition, right? I mean, here you are, and in this moment, and in this moment, and in this moment, it is entirely possible to generate an intention that is positive, that is inclined towards the good, that is inclined towards enlightenment, regardless of what sorts of previous karma you may be experiencing the finishing results of now. But I hear you, and I don't. My answer doesn't entirely resolve these questions.
Just to follow up on that, doesn't the doctrine of no self somehow preclude the concept of deserving? I mean, what's deserving this condition?
Well, on an ultimate level, nobody's deserving it, and that sometimes is a kind of consolation. But again, most Buddhists, including Mahayana Buddhists who love to be paradoxical, still operate in this conventional realm and still tend to think along these lines. I mean, I know my main teacher is a Tibetan Lama in Madison who can, talk Madhyamaka philosophy about emptiness, for days on end and still be full of energy as we're all flagging. So he gets this stuff. In fact, he's one of the most famous Madhyamaka thinkers of the modern era. When Thomas Merton visited the Dalai Lama many years ago, the Dalai Lama said, go study emptiness with Geshe Zopa. But Geshe Zopa, on the other hand, is a perfectly traditional Lama in regarding the kinds of things being described here as conventionally quite true. So ultimately, you don't deserve it. But conventionally, on some level, if we mean by deserve that there will be an outcome to something done previously that is commensurate with it, and in that sense, you deserved it.
Yeah, just one more problem.
Okay. Yeah.
Real quick, I just wanted to say, going back to what people were talking about with handicaps and stuff, I have a younger brother with severe autism, and I work with him right now, taking care of him, and I see, so much peace in him that I'm not able to have in the same sense that he does, but then in the same sense, I have all this freedom that he will never be able to have. And then I always would think when I was younger, why was I born normal and why was he born with severe autism?
Mm-hmm.
And I can't fully explain it. In some ways, he teaches me so much and is more enlightened than I will ever be. And I kind of point that out that even though I can't explain the why, just being in his presence, he teaches me a lot as somebody who's, quote, normal.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good point. And I couldn't say it better myself.
Well, thanks again, Roger, for coming, and thanks, everyone.